How much of American consumerism is a reaction to fear?
And I thought that was just such a strange imperative to declare on the citizens of the United States to go out and shop.
Recording the gotta have it reaction to a post 9/11 reality. Plus, why have we given up on recycling? I'm Susan Barnett, and this is 51%, the Women's Perspective. American retailers moved in on Thanksgiving this year, with stores opening on Thanksgiving Day in an effort to get a better shot at your gift budget. Walmart's offered its employees a turkey dinner and time and a half. The National Retail Federation expected 33 million people to buy into the shopping frenzy, skipping the cranberry sauce for more time at Toys R Us. Brian Ulrich's book, Is This Place Great or What?, is a decade-long photographic study of consumerism in America, post 9/11. He follows the arc from big box store to thrift store to abandoned shopping malls, holding a mirror up to our society's love of retail. He spoke with Sarah McConnell of With Good Reason.
Brian Ulrich has spent the last decade photographing the landscape of consumerism across the United States. He captures the blank stares of shoppers and the mountains of stuff in front of them. His book is called, Is This Place Great or What? Brian, you began your project right after 9/11.
You know, there was this tragedy that happened where everybody understood what was going on and everybody was grieving. And it was not long after that that the dialogue within the culture started to shift towards fear and kind of like, look out and they're coming again and the bad guys are out to get us, which, you know, there is truth mix in there, certainly. But in all of that came this kind of rhetoric of shopping. And I thought that was just such a strange imperative to declare on the citizens of the United States to go out and shop. And I was really curious about that. It seemed like a very opposite kind of reaction. Like, I had grown up with stories of World War II and the way that this country pulled together its resources at that time. So to have the rhetoric shift to kind of spend and kind of move back into your selfishness as a way to rebuild was a very strange thing. So that was really what my curiosity was. I wanted to see if people were actually doing that.
And what did you find?
Well, the funny thing is I kind of quickly answered my question, which was, yes, they were. Every sale was a kind of red, white, and blue sale, and there were plenty of flags and ribbon magnets.
Were you at first deliberately going to only the so-called big box stores?
I grew up in Long Island, New York, so this big box store thing was a really different thing for me. I was fascinated with that whole idea of just a huge, giant box that was filled with everything you would conceivably want. But it was really interesting because those places were so homogenized. For instance, a Target in Las Vegas is the same as a Target in Granger, Indiana, is the same as Short Pump.
So what was the experience for you like to deliberately go in time and time and time again?
It looks weird. And it is weird to go to a big box store and sit there, or a mall, with no imperative other than to observe. I started researching how marketers study the science of consumer habits. They call it tracking. They'll photograph or videotape everything people do from the minute they walk into the door of the store to the minute they leave, because there's so many psychological subtleties happening in these spaces. And that's what photography can actually do, is you can see these psychological moments happening. There's a heavy amount of decision-making that happens in picking up the thing and deciding, do I actually need it? One specific example would be a picture in the book that's a young woman who's standing in front of an aisle of cheese in a grocery store, and she's talking on the cell phone, sunglasses on her head, purse in hand, empty cart behind her. So what's kind of wonderful about this simple little moment is that she's kind of also, her whole body language is actually kind of reeling back away from the wall of choice that is before her. On the cover of the book, there's a photograph of a young woman who was working at a thrift store in Seattle, Washington, and she's really kind of totally surrounded by a giant pile of used donation clothes. to me, what was amazing about this girl was that she was Madonna-like, you know? She really kind of had this ownership of herself in that space, even though she was totally compressed by this kind of wall of color and garments and stuff. This is this environment that we all exist in. We, you know, the thrift chapter of the book moved into the idea of course, as much as we buy things, those things have to go somewhere. There has to be a repository for those things. Middle class casts off all their used things. They end up in this space. The guilt is absolved, but of course, like, the mountain of stuff is tremendous and profound and a real problem that people have to deal with all the time.
You have a picture in there, for instance, of a wall of computers, sort of early generation computers.
Yeah.
And it's depressing because you realize nobody can use or wants those things.
Yeah. When I first made that picture, I used to go to the Apple store in Chicago and put that on all the screensavers. It would last about 5 minutes, but yeah. It seemed to me that thrift is an allegory for a culture that sets in place a remedy for a system, right? So that the people in the thrift stores and the thrift stores themselves are the ones to solve these kind of last level problems of, well, we make too much stuff. You kind of deal with it.
In your final section of the book, you look at big box stores after the fall.
Yeah. That was something that actually I had in mind all the way back to 2005. I remember writing some notes about the fact that this economic model was really, really unsustainable, that the final chapter of this project would be empty stores. In 2008, it became really clear that it was time to do that because of what was happening economically in the U.S. All these things are weird because, you know, you go and you travel across the country to see a closed Target, and then you realize it's the same as the one that's down the street from where you left. The landscape of this country was really pumped up on this idea that this model would last forever and would continue to profit. And as it shrunk so fast that so many places became empty so quickly. A mall in Harvey, Illinois, which recently just got demolished completely after being sitting abandoned for almost 40 years. Now we see this picture of it in 2009, and it looks like a scene from the Titanic. Everything is kind of dripping away. You can see rust and iron and debris. And it's kind of nice to see them just go back to being a landscape again. Sadly, often what happens is that even if a place gets bulldozed, it's bulldozed with the intention of turning it into a new version of its old self. And as if they figured it out this time. You know, I think Victor Gruen, the Swiss architect who worked on some of the earliest shopping malls in the United States, he really didn't see these so much as profit centers, but as community centers. And he really wanted to make this idea of a community enclosed where people would come together. But of course, as soon as people realized how much profit was to be made at these places, why would they actually have like a stage for a musical performance when they could have like a kiosk that could sell cell phone wrappers? You know?
Things we need.
Yes.
Brian Ulrich teaches photography at Virginia Commonwealth University. His new book is called Is This Place Great or What? To see photographs from his project, visit our website, withgoodreasonradio.org.
Coming up, our recycling efforts look pretty pale if you compare us to Canada. And Gilles Malkin profiles a film star who used her celebrity to help the world's children. If you missed part of this show or want to share it, visit the 51% archives at WAMC.org. This week's show is number 1274. Most of us don't spend a lot of time thinking about garbage, but author and teacher Catherine Breeze does. Breeze thinks back to her 1979 science class and wonders why, after decades of environmental education, we still don't seem to get it.
Recently, thanks to unemployment, I have been afforded the opportunity to spend significant time in contemplation. One of the things I have spent time thinking about is garbage, and I have decided that human beings are vile creatures. I have spent some additional time wondering why, but have not arrived at an answer to that. Garbage is hard to get rid of, apparently. I mean, I have never had a problem disposing of it in a garbage receptacle, but obviously it is trouble for some folks. On a recent hike through a nature preserve, I observed, among other improperly disposed items, a dirty diaper. Now, this was a hike through a national park, which leads to a grotto on Georgian Bay, one of the single most gorgeous places I have personally ever seen. Craggy cliffs, caves, and stunning blue water that rivals the Caribbean. The park is well-staffed, the hiking paths are well-maintained, and there are garbage and recycling stations throughout. So here we are in a place where we have specifically traveled to witness the grandeur of the planet, and some parent changes a poopy diaper and drops it on the ground. What the heck? The extra effort involved in conveying the smelly thing to the trash can was just too much for this parent, this person who had somehow managed to carry a baby, or even a toddler, on a 3-mile hike. So he or she left this ghastly gift for someone else to clean up. How can we as fellow human creatures explain this? It is utterly illogical. While sheer laziness can be cited to explain the sea of shopping carts left all over the Walmart parking lot, it does not do to explain this particular level of selfishness. Impossible question aside, what then happens to garbage properly canned? Well, it's off to the landfill. I have been to several of these usefully hidden places during my adult life. Recently even, I have had occasion to venture to a Canadian landfill, which, you will be glad to know, is exactly as disgusting and odoriferous as its American counterpart. The Canadians are doing a tremendously better job with recycling, but I'll get to that later. Landfills are as horrible as they are useful. When we arrived, our car was weighed, and we were told to follow the road until we saw the sign for household trash. We passed a truckload of old mattresses, an area for propane containers, a scrap metal site, a construction wastes area, and finally, there was the household waste. It was a mountain of earth, sand, and every conceivable kind of human refuse. A giant yellow caterpillar was pushing the waste into the hills, while seagulls circled madly. The smell was nauseating and overpowering. It took a couple of hours to get it out of our nostrils. But I also feel grateful for the men and women who work the landfill. Because of them, and this place, my home and yard can be tidy and manicured. Public and private spaces everywhere can be clean and lovely. Humanity can feel decent about itself and its hygiene. A visit to a landfill should be a required part of school curriculum. If we are teaching children the really important things to know, how to play kickball, where your epiglottis is, the formula to calculate the area of a rhombus, the name of Romeo's best friend, etc., then shouldn't we also teach them a handful of vital facts about communal existence? Among the most important things we seem to leave out, where does your water come from? Where and how is your electricity made? Where does your sewage, garbage, and recycling go? Why don't we want children to know the answers to these questions? Perhaps it is because my generation is embarrassed about what it has done with the water, air, and natural resources we were given. When I was in the 9th grade, 1979, Mr. Danilovic taught me earth science. During one unit of study, we were each given a shoe-sized box and several items of post-consumer refuse. We filled our boxes with dirt and buried the items inside. After a time, we dug through the dirt to discover what had happened. The piece of recently invented biodegradable plastic had melted away, and the newspaper had yellowed. Nothing else happened. The glass, styrofoam, and other objects were as new. I assume that we were supposed to decide, based on this experiment, that we should be recycling and/or reusing human creations, or maybe choosing biodegradable packaging. Whatever the lesson was, my classmates and I didn't seem to learn it. Recycling is the nagging wife of the consumer-based economy, or should I say nagging ex-wife, because mostly we seem to have given up on the marriage. We pay lip service to it and put out in our blue bins the types of things that each of our towns or cities accept in their recycling programs. The rest goes into the bigger can at the curb. When my town of South Charleston, West Virginia, stopped taking glass because it was too expensive to recycle, there was nary a peep heard. My ranting Facebook post was responded to by exactly one friend. Tossing perfectly usable and reusable glass containers into the landfill? Sure, not a problem, as long as it's done by a small, quiet, uniformed group of people and kept far away from my neighborhood where I don't have to see it or smell it. Why are we packaging products inside of something we can't or won't recycle or reuse? Because it's cheap. America seems to be paradoxically run by both apathy and greed. We live a life filled with things that are supposed to make us happy, and those things come packaged in lots and lots of stuff that we have to throw away. As long as there's plenty of landfill space, then I guess we're all okay with that. Because I spent some weeks this past summer in Ontario, Canada, I've gotten to see garbage from a fresh angle. To begin with, all liquor and beer containers can be returned to the store for a refund of a small deposit. This discourages roadside tossing. Additionally, right in the middle of nowhere, Ontario, we can recycle all of the following: glass bottles and jars, every aluminum product you can name, every plastic numbered 1 through 7, except 6, every type of paper, including magazines, molded retail packaging, plastic construction buckets, clamshell plastic, empty aerosol cans, plastic inserts, every type of cardboard, and paper towel and toilet paper rolls. The blue recycle bin itself is the number 5, fully recyclable. While they cannot accept styrofoam items or plastic furniture, they are seriously crushing the United States in the recycling game. This summer, we also bought a new flat-screen TV set. At the bottom of the receipt was a $39 fee for appliance disposal. What? We asked. But you see, in Canada, they don't want old TV sets tossed down ravines or resting in river eddies or piled up on front porches. They also don't want to see Asian children poisoned in the labor of deconstructing electronic devices. So, they let you drop off your old TV set at a special location for free. If you buy a new TV, you pay a fee that covers the proper disposal of all things electronic. Of course, Americans would never put up with such nonsense. We want our TVs, all 5 of them per American family, to be cheap, cheap, cheap. Taxes are for suckers. Okay, I admit I am biased. Yes, my diction has been inflammatory. All of humanity is not a horrific, garbage-spewing monster. I do have friends who care about the environment, who wash out their plastic lunch containers and recycle them, and who do take other people's pop cans home from work. I know people who compost. I know people who purchased hybrid cars and drive them pretty darn close to the speed limit. My sister makes beautiful purses from discarded ties and other used fabrics. There is a slow but persistent movement toward environmental respect, I hope. But I swore in 1979 that I would never buy another styrofoam plate, and I have not. I believed Thoreau when he said that one man's refusal could change the world. But styrofoam is still everywhere. You see it in packing peanuts, packaging, coffee cups, and picnic wear. In fact, it is the absolute least expensive of the picnic products. High-quality biodegradable paper plates are the most expensive. Then I get behind this hulking 400-horsepower pickup truck, dangling plastic testicles from the hitch and bearing a Magnetic Gas Company sticker on the door. He passes me going about 75 miles per hour on an Ohio country road, racing away from the fracking site where he is employed. Energy independence? Now that's a contradiction wrapped inside an irony. If you have listened to here, and bless you for doing so, I will now conclude. Why haven't more people embraced the environmental movement? It's not that Mr. Danilovic's class didn't work, or that people are inherently lazy and or stupid. It's that everybody didn't have Mr. Danilovic as their science teacher, and everybody didn't really learn that it takes somewhere between 1,000 and 1 million plus years to decompose a single styrofoam plate. Once you know that, it's just so obvious what the right choice is.
And finally, Gilles Malkin profiles one of the most iconic women of the last generation, a film star who became an ambassador for the world's children.
One aspect of glamorous women is that they make us believe that life in the spotlight is a dream come true, and the better they are at making us believe that, the more we exalt them. One of the most elegant, glamorous, and convincing women to ever charm us on the Hollywood screen was Audrey Hepburn. And the marvelous truth is that behind the facade, she was as down-to-earth, caring, and kind as she was glamorous. Audrey Hepburn was born in 1929 in England of a Dutch mother and a British father. Her father abandoned the family when she was six, which she later related to be an intensely traumatic event to her. Much later, in 1959, she sought him out, and from that time until he died in 1980, she sent him money regularly. She went to an English boarding school, but her mother brought her back to Holland as World War II was breaking out in 1939, believing that would be a safer place. In May of the following year, when German troops invaded, Hepburn was warned by her mother never to speak English in public. She was forced to hide and grew weak from hunger and emerged from the ordeal with asthma, jaundice, and other results of malnutrition, and she was plagued with nutritional disorders and weight problems for the rest of her life. Her single escape from the horror around her was her ballet lessons. She trained hard, and despite noticeable talent, she came to realize in her late teens that she was just too small to be a star, and it became evident that her future lay elsewhere. She'd landed a few small roles in films and as a chorus girl in theater productions. She got her first sizable role in 1951 and then was noticed by the French author Colette, who insisted that she would be the perfect actress for the stage production of her novel Gigi. Her subsequent movie role in Roman Holiday opened in 1953, and she became an overnight global sensation and was awarded the Oscar for Best Actress. She also received an Emmy the next year for her role in the Broadway play Ondine. As wonderfully successful as Audrey Hepburn was in her acting career, it wasn't until 1987 that she connected with and began the most important work of her life, the work of a UNICEF Goodwill ambassador. She needed to repay the debt she owed them for saving her from starvation in 1945. Her image as a beautiful, elegant, charismatic, and benign figure would have been gold to any cause, but Hepburn was much more than just a figurehead. The plight of feeding and saving the poorest children became her highest priority, and she dedicated her entire life to the work of creating awareness for it. Audrey Hepburn met with heads of state to appeal to them to save millions of people who would starve unless they acted. She stressed that there was plenty of money. It was just that the world lacked the will to prioritize these tasks. There was plenty of food in Ethiopia, for example, but it could not be distributed because of civil wars. The Red Cross and UNICEF had both been ordered out so that the fighting could continue. In June of 1989, she addressed the United Nations, making a timeless, ringing endorsement for the revision of priorities in the world. She said, "How is it that governments spend so much on warfare and bypass the needs of their children, their greatest capital, their only hope for peace, until they not only can be assured of physically surviving the first fragile years of life, but are free of emotional, social, and physical abuse? It's impossible to envisage a world that is free of tension and violence. But it's up to us to make it possible," she said. "Together, there is nothing we cannot do." Audrey Hepburn died in her home in Switzerland of cancer in 1993 at age 63. Thank you for listening. For 51% and Women in History, I'm Gilles Malkin.
Gilles Malkin is a writer, actor, and musician. He lives in New York's Catskill Mountains. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our theme music is by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. You can also email me at sbarnett@wamc.org. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another edition of 51%, The Women's Perspective.